The Kurusha Kshatriyas were the kings of the northern direction. They were celebrated protectors of Brahminical culture and were all firmly religious. From the son of Manu, named Drishta, came a Kshatriya caste called Darshta, whose members achieved the position of Brahmanas in this world. Then, from the son of Manu, named Driga, came Sumati. From Sumati came Bhutajyoti, and from Bhutajyoti came Vasu. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Here it is said, Chatram Brahma Bhuyam Gatam Chito. Although the Darshtas belonged to the Kshatriya caste, they were able to convert themselves into Brahmanas. This gives clear evidence supporting the following statement by Narada. If the qualities of one group are found in the men of another, those men should be recognized by their qualities, by their symptoms, not by the caste of the family in which they were born. Birth is not at all important. It is one's qualities that are stressed in all Vedic literature. Om Ganate Namandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuram Malitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guru Yashetanya Manovistam Stapitam Nilabhutale Swayam Rupakadam Ayadadate Svapanantikam Andeham Shri Guru Sriyata Parakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sakachatam Sahaguna Raghunatam Vidam Stam Satiram Advaitam Sarvadutam Bhadejana Sahiza Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Agana Vadita Shri Vishakam Svidamsa E Krishna Karana Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastate Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhana Sute Devi Hanuman Hari Priya Panchaka Putrivyasya Kripa Sindhu Vivacha Patitanam Bhavanibhyo Vaishnavi Srila Prabhupada takes advantage of every opportunity to remind us that the caste of one's birth is not as important as the qualities one displays, and by cultivating qualities of a higher birth, one can, through second birth, attain what is described here by these Kshatriyas who became Brahmanas by a purificatory process of second birth. In this chapter, the dynasties of the sons of Manu, we hear about so many generations and who took birth from who. And one thing we repeatedly hear is that despite whatever arrangements and challenges occurred in life, repeatedly we hear, as in the dilemma of Sujumna, who born a girl, was transformed into a boy, and then cursed to become a girl, and then blessed to become a boy half the time. And it was just very perplexing for everybody. And then Prashadra, who, by such an unfortunate arrangement of providence, having dedicated himself to the protection of cows, when the cows were attacked by a tiger at night, pitch black, dark night, he mistakenly killed the cow, thinking he was protecting the cow by killing the tiger. But in all unfortunate and fortunate, relatively speaking, situations, we repeatedly hear that the perfection was going to the forest in the later stage of life. And this concept of retiring from the responsibilities of practical life and going to the forest was the way, was the answer that Sri Prahlad gave to his father when he questioned him, "What's the best thing you've learned in school?" "Best thing I've learned is that one should go to the forest, you know, giving up his mundane responsibilities and go to the forest, especially Vrindavan, to take shelter of Krishna." And Srila Prabhupada personified that mood. He was destined by astrological calculations to be amongst the richest men in India, to be very successful. And his life was proceeding in that direction up until a certain point when everything started going wrong. And he tried and tried, and he was very responsible in his family obligations and other responsibilities. And then when he read in Srimad Bhagavatam, "Yasyaham anugrihami harishe tadramshina," he thought, "Oh no, could this be what's happening?" And he confided in this one of his godbrothers, "I think I'm experiencing this verse." And his godbrother said, "Yes." And then Srila Prabhupada began disentangling himself from other responsibilities to go to Vrindavan, where in the association of Radha Damodar, the shelter of Rupa Goswami, he imbibed the Brijabasi spirit. But he didn't stay there. He wanted what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu desired, that the Brijabasi spirit, which is too precious to keep to oneself, be broadcast and distributed to the world. And Srila Prabhupada, in his initial success of preaching in America, attracted some devotees who he trained to be brahmanas. But then at a certain point, he began emphasizing varnashram. And the more brahminically inclined devotees were questioning, "Why do we need varnashram if we're brahmanas?" And Srila Prabhupada replied that to sustain your position, as well as to facilitate others who are not in that high of a position, we need varnashram, because Western civilization and all those who are following it are so immersed in the consequences of a plundering, technological, industrial world that all the activities and occupations offered by such a society are Ugra Karma. And even though it may appear very desirable, and you see, you know, Americans imitating Indians now, you see, and why should we so struggle so hard trying to establish farm communities, which are a necessary step in pursuit of Varnashram, when we see our Indian godbrothers, they have their college degrees, which awards them these fine occupations and lucrative paychecks, and they don't work that many hours. So, you know, we see Americans trying to imitate that, but the Americans don't have the support of a culture in which husband and wife are really committed to stay together. And then you have the resources of, you know, grandmothers for babysitting and wisdom and just the culture that gives you the support to be successful in any occupation. But that's also based on this multinational corporation plundering system. Basically, there's two kinds of civilizations in the world. There's agricultural, which produces their own needs, and then there's plundering, those who just go take from others. But never before has a society had such ability to plunder the resources of all the local economies in the world. Now, in local economy, you don't take more than what that economy can sustain. So your future generations are guaranteed livelihood and sustenance. The multinational bankers hiding behind the scenes of these multinational corporations do not consider when to stop exploiting the local cultures. And with all their offers to give them wealth and give them loans for which they can purchase technological achievements and flourish in life, they always end up so indebted that they have to come back to the multinational bankers, and then they have to put up their land for the next loan. And when they can't come through with the payments, which are so manipulated to appear to be not violating the ancient covenants against usury, but are actually just expert at manipulating it, these people are forfeiting their lands. So Srila Prabhupada wanted that we introduce Varnashram so that we could gradually divorce ourselves from the very imperceptible, subtle, but detrimental influences of this ravaging industrial complex. And who is really pulling the strings on this whole conglomeration? You read in the Srimad Bhagavatam how after Kali, being given shelter by Maharaj Parikshit in the hoarding of gold and proliferating through the pretense that there is gold backing to the paper and plastic currency when there really isn't, falsity, which Kali really got a foothold in his age. And the dynasty of Kali began proliferating. We read in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And we see symptomatically the dynasties of Kali are proliferating more today in the form of these multinational bankers who are exploiting and putting into debt all the rest of the world, who ends up forfeiting their seeds, their land, and not even having good water to drink. So never before has the world had the option, you know, formerly we hear of such things as fratricidal war, but never before has there been the option of omnicide and geocide as we face today. Not to get in a doom and gloom mood, to give passion to our aspiration, because despite the very bleak predicament of the world today, if you look at it like the indigenous people, you know, we need to hear from the mother people of the fatherland as well as the father people of the motherland. We need to understand the history of America before Columbus came to understand how this ecology was meant to work. And the indigenous people, they would evaluate any action today on how it would affect seven generations down the line. So if you look seven generations down the line, the prognosis looks extremely bleak. But we have great confidence from Srimad Bhagavatam that the earth has tremendous ability to heal herself of any inflictions if she is pleased to do so. And what pleases her? When her children are taking her gifts to use in sacrifice for the pleasure of Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada uses a term regarding Kali entering into the, first it was the gold currency and then proliferating into the multinational bankers. He uses this astute term, prostitution of wealth, which obviously means that that kind of paper and plastic wealth will not stay with any man or give him any real satisfaction for long at all. Just the illusion. But more deeply, prostitution of wealth means that that kind of artificial opulence is not inclined to serve Krishna. It's not inclined towards sacrifice. And therefore, the infatuation with such artificial lifestyle leads us where? You see, you know, people who think they're really going to make it and pay back their loans and mortgages but aren't able, they end up going, you see in some towns, rows of stores that goes from the bank where you can't pay back your loan to the pawn shop where you sell off everything you have for a fraction of what it's worth, and next is the blood bank where you sell your blood. There are literal streets like that. But the figurative illustration and lesson is quite obvious. And the educational system, which Srila Prabhupada called slaughterhouse, what does this mean? You know, the message of the world today is, you don't have any God-given gifts. You don't have any God-given abilities. You can't make it in the world. You have to come to us, the educational institution, to get the skills and the confidence to make it in our world. That's the antithesis of what Varnashram states. We all have God-given gifts, abilities, and calling, which, if recognized, appreciated, and honored, leads one into an occupation where he finds satisfaction because he's pleasing Krishna. But no, come to the educational institution to become cogs in the corporate wheel. And you think that by good sadhana you can protect your consciousness from the hideous, subtle influences which corrode relationships and corrupt consciousness and saps your very life force. Chaitanya means life force, Srila Prabhupada said. And he came to remind us about the opulence of the forest of Vrindavan. During the Lakshmi Vijaya, during Ratha Yatra, when Lakshmi Devi comes out with her maidservants and they capture and bind the servants of Jagannath and tie them up and mock them and humiliate them. And Srivas Thakur, supporting the mood of Lakshmi Devi, question, how is it that your Lord Jagannath, who is so expert at everything, could give up the supreme opulence of the goddess of fortune, and in preference to a few leaves, twigs, and peacock feathers, go to Vrindavan to take shelter in Srimati Radharani's garden? If your master is so expert at everything, why does he do such things? And Mahaprabhu is deriving great pleasure. He said, your mood is just like Narada Muni. The Lord's opulences influence your consciousness. Ask Swarup Damodar, he's a pure devotee of Vrindavan. He doesn't know what opulence is because he's simply immersed in pure devotional service. Swarup Damodar rose to the occasion and said, my dear Srivas, please listen with attention and I will inform you about the nature of the opulence of Braj. In Vrindavan, every speck of dust is Chintamani, far surpassing the opulence of all the Vaikunthas. These gopis, cowherd girls, are super goddesses of fortune, far surpassing the splendor of Lakshmi Devi and Vaikuntha. The trees are kalpavrikshas, they fulfill all your desires. The cows, kamadenas, they give you whatever you want. All motion is dance. Communication is all song. And it's all orchestrated harmoniously, like a grand symphony by the original song of Krishna's flute, which conveys his heartless love by means of the airways to the entire environment. Srila Prabhupada wanted to establish higher education, and he began with very revolutionary definitions and titles. Like, he explained that PhD, which we hold so highly in this world, he said it really means plow department. And to the farm folks who already knew that, this was very enlivening. Because you hear people talk, and I don't know what they mean, they talk about their degrees. They have, what is it, BS, and, or, what is it? MA, MS, P, I don't know. But we were informed that BS means manure from a bull, which is slightly more precious than the milk from a cow. MS means more of the same, and PhD means it's piled higher and deeper. I don't know, did you learn this in school? Is this something you only learn? And Srila Prabhupada said that if you can't make it, you don't even need to go to school if you just study nature. I was so happy to hear that because I didn't go to school and I preferred to study nature. So I was thinking, Srila Prabhupada's teaching is very revolutionary. And now that the wielder of the plow is here, what does that plow signify? Other than its practical aspect of representing or identifying the patron deity of ox power in agriculture, the plow, it was considered a sacramental function even for the emperors, not only of India, but even in China, to plow the sacrificial arena. What is this alluding to? Turning over that old vegetation which needs to be recycled, opening the furrow. It's a male symbol, the plow, but it's related to the furrow, which is the womb of the earth, in which the Lord wants to place the seed of bhakti and entrust his servants here on earth to the care and protection of that seed, to its fruition in which it's meant to be distributed. This is the sacramental dimension in which we participate in the noble occupation that Srila Prabhupada called it, agriculture. So, and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Krishna Samhita and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, I think Professor Sanyal, elaborated in their own ways, the demonology, what the demons, Brud, Leela demons, and then Mathura and Dwarka, what they represent in terms of the anarthas within the kingdom of our heart and how Krishna helps us to overcome them. And Srila Prabhupada didn't talk like this because, the hippies were so prone to take everything as symbolic. And he wanted to establish that Krishna Leela is not symbolic. But the Absolute is rich in symbology. It's the universal language composed of the alphabet of archetypes, which speaks to all souls of all times and all places and whatever level of advancement they're on. And symbology is the language by which you receive news of your relationship with the earth and the environment and the universe. And is very much suppressed and distorted and squelched by the pollution of the ether from the propaganda and the media and the lies promoted from the bench of the high court judges, which just pollutes the ether. So the pollution of the ecosystem, which is contaminating our air, water, soils, and food, it's just an outgrowth of pollution in consciousness, beginning with the ether. Anyway, when Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur began this demonology presentation, and he explains how, Krishna helps us internally overcoming the demon, the anarthas within our hearts, in which we have a graphic outward display in the way he deals with the demons, he says an interesting thing, that there are certain demons that Krishna doesn't kill, because to kill those demons, to overcome those obstacles, there's more emphasis on your own endeavor. So every but devotee thinks, well, what use is my own endeavor in overcoming anarthas? And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur answers that demons like Dhenukasura and Kalamba, who are killed by Baladev, illustrate those anarthas which necessitates the cultivation and practice of humility to the degree it becomes so deep and genuine that the mood of Baladev awakens in our consciousness, and he overcomes those obstacles within the kingdom, kills those demons within the kingdom of our heart. So in approach to sadhana, as well as Braj Leela, we have to first petition the Lord to cast out these anarthas, and then admit our utter helplessness and defeat . This is the secret mystery of Braj Leela. So, what is it about Dhenukasura? And all the demons, they have their grosser and subtler natures. The gross subtle of Dhenukasura is the ass-like, dull-headed fool mentality that thinks, carrying this heavy load of anarthas throughout life, like the washerman's donkey carrying the dirty laundry, is all there is. You don't think about karma and dharma and bhakti and sacrifice just carrying this heavy load. That's the growth. The subtler is even though donkeys are considered lowly, they also have a virtuous nature. Why did Jesus ride a donkey into Jerusalem? Well, and amongst other things, they're a very good guard animal. That's why you see him in herds of sheep, to protect them from the wolves. So Kamsa chose donkeys to guard the Taliban, which means the smarta mentality, the corrupt smarta mentality, that we have access to this high, sweet fruit. But we, the brahmanas, are the only qualified ones. And the rest of the world has to come through us to receive this fruit. I have access to the fruit, but I will not distribute it freely and indiscriminately. A mood that Lord Chaitanya came to adjust. And then there's Pralamba, who, on the gross level is pride and lust, but on the deeper level, the either active or passive belief that guru can be separated from Krishna. Because Pralamba was thinking that it appears that Krishna is very powerful, and I don't know if I can kill him. But Baladev, if he's not so powerful, so I'll take him away and kill him. And then, who is Pralamba? The thief in disguise, who really strives to steal away yourself from itself. So what does he initially do? They're playing cops and robbers and sheep and shepherds, and whoever lost had to carry his victor on his shoulders. So Balaram lost. Pralamba won. And he had to carry. Pralamba had to carry Balaram. And Balaram became very light to encourage Pralamba, just run far, far away. And he did. But then Balaram was fearful. Where's he taking me? This is not part of the rules of the game. He's taking me away from my friends and from Krishna. And further, he was more frightened that maybe there's another Pralamba there taking Krishna away. And what about the devotees? I'm their protector. So he got angry and he got heavy. And Pralamba is faltering and he rose up into the sky. And then Balaram, he just gave up his fright and fear and clobbered him in the head and brought him crashing down. This is the spirit of Baladev. And sometimes Srila Prabhupada would say very surprising things, especially when talking about such personalities as scientists, Mayavadis, or Sahajas. He would say things just out of the blue, like, I kicked their heads with my boots. Obviously, this is not to be taken literally. But where did that spirit and mood come from? When talking about these people who are trying to take away Krishna, trying to take away the necessity of guru, this is Pralamba. And what is the motivation? The same as everything in this material world. We just somehow have to remove Krishna so that I can be the enjoyer and the center and the controller. And the whole Mayavad doctrine is just so amazing. That, Shankaracharya, who's Lord Shiva, the greatest Vaishnava, would promote this Mayavad doctrine. And these sannyasis would be so austere, more so than Vaishnavas, dedicating their life to studying Sanskrit just to manipulate the texts to believe that ultimately the deity is Maya, the Guru is Maya, Krishna is Maya, the Paramatma is Maya. We just merge, we become the Supreme. And Srila Prabhupada was so emphatic about such things as reading other books, and devotees would argue, but they're saying the same thing that you do. And they may be. But it's not just the words in the scripture. It's the intent in the spirit of the compiler of those words that influences you subtly. And there are Mayavadis who are very devoted, even in private, not to make a show, and very humble and very austere and very emotional when they come before the deity. And they appear to be great Vaishnavas. And if you take their shelter and win their trust, they will reveal to you at some time that you are now qualified for the most confidential knowledge. That beyond this deity form, and beyond the soul and the paramatma, is the ultimate, non-differentiated, uncharacterized nothingness in which we are blessed to enter and merge. And in Chaitanya Lila, you know, Bhagavan Acharya, who was very simple, wanted his brother to come and associate with the devotees, but he was from Varanasi. Sri Damodara was saying, no, it is. And Sri Damodara was giving so many arguments, and as was Bhagavan Acharya, we're so surrendered to Mahaprabhu, we could not be deviated by this Mayavad. Sri Damodara said that may be true. But hearing their beloved Lord described as having no form, no qualities, no lila, it just breaks the hearts of the devotees. And hearing that, Bhagavan Acharya went home and told his brother, time to go back to Varanasi. So, the plow, it signifies that as Krishna is related to the cows, Balaram is to the oxen. And also, the plow is like an irresistible draw that just, you know, it can't be stopped. And, you know, as Sankarshan is gravity, which, you know, pulls everything towards the center, his plow, it pulls the living entities towards Krishna, but it also attracts Krishna to the living entities, because Baladev, he's Guru Tattva, or shelter. So when Krishna was in Dwarka, the queens, who spent more time with him than anyone, became acutely aware that Krishna is really someplace else. You know, he's with us in form, and he performs his duties, but his heart is someplace else. And at night, when Krishna would sleep, the queens would hear him calling out to the cows. And though he longed to return to Braj, he made no attempt to do so. And that longing in Krishna's heart just haunted him more and more and more. His heart was possessed by the Brijavasis. And he stayed in Dwarka largely because his first concern was for the Brijavasis, and he was contemplating that they suffer more in my presence than they do in my absence. Because when I'm with them, they're just haunted by this fear of imminent separation, that he could leave any time. When I'm gone, they're so much immersed internally in my pastimes that the ecstasy and bliss which they incessantly immerse themselves in Vipralamba, far surpasses the sporadic joy they feel in my presence. So better, I don't go back. It'll just cause them more pain. That was Krishna's reasoning, which was not pleasing or convincing to Baladev, who tried so many ways and times to convince his brother to go back, as did Rohini and others. So I sent Uddhava, you send your servant to the Brijabasis, who dedicated and surrendered everything for you. And for them, you send your servant. You won't go. So Balaram did not approve of either Krishna's behavior nor his reasoning. So he said, well, I'll go. So hearing that Baladev was going to go to the Brijavasis, Krishna thought, well, maybe I should go. If Balaram goes, I should go. But then when the Yadus caught wind of this, they feigned illness, and the queens were pouting, and the children were crying, and Krishna realized that this will be a disaster. So, empathetic to the plight of the Brijavasis, Baladev resolved, I'll go along. But on the way from Dwarka to Braj, Balaram, who's possessed of unlimited powers, began feeling more and more the weight of the mission entrusted, not even entrusted, he took it upon himself. The message had ever-increasing weight. How would he face the gopis? Because he had a different mood. Now, to them, he was, big brother, respected elder, a guru. How could he convey the unique love of Krishna's heart to all the individual gopis? So first he went to Nanda and Yashoda, Baladev, returning from Dwarka, sitting in their lap, bathed by their tears. And as if with a thousand mouths of Sankarshan, his kirtan, narrating, singing Krishna's pastimes, brought solace to the Brijabasis. And their hearts soared, although they were breathless. And without blinking or moving, they were listening so attentively. But when Baladev, the infinite, deep, grave ocean of mellows, came before the gopis, he felt the shifting tide and turbulent currents of their bhav just drawing him into the current of their love, which is very contradictory. Now, first they were chastising and criticizing Krishna. He's ungrateful, he's an ingrate, and they gave so many examples to prove their points. But then when they remembered his sweet smile and his loving gestures and his deep kindness, the flow of their love was like going different directions. It was going this way, and then like an eddy, it was going the other way. And Balaram was being drawn into the nature of their love. And then when he began to narrate Krishna's message, he was thinking, it'll be easy to relay the words that Krishna conveyed to the Brijabasis, but how to convey the love inherent to his message? A mood unknown to anyone else. And when he recited Krishna's words, the gopis were not satisfied. If Krishna was conveying in his letter how much he loved them, then why didn't he come to them? So Balaram was in a dilemma. And to save Balaram in his dilemma, Krishna appeared in his mind. And Krishna found that from his opulent room in Dwarka, where the crashing sea waves on the shore resounded, and interspersed with the symphony of the Dwarka birds chanting reverential hymns, Krishna found himself in a moonlit kunj with the sweet sound of the waves lapping on Jamuna's shores, and the sweet singing of the Brijavasi birds. And then Krishna found himself face to face with the gopis, in the mind of Balaram. And Balaram was not speaking, because the gopis wanted Krishna. And hearing Krishna's words through the mouth of Baladev created an incongruity which was not pleasing to the gopis. And Baladev sensed this, and he was in a predicament. So Krishna, who had appeared in his mind, expressing himself through Baladev's words, confused the gopis all the more and more. They were seeing before us Krishna, Shyam, dressed in yellow cloth. I mean, we're seeing Baladev, white complexion, dressed in blue cloth, but we're hearing Krishna. What is going on? And then Baladev was in a more serious dilemma. And then, to relieve him of the predicament, for a brief instant, Krishna actually appeared in place of Baladev. That lightning white complexion form of Baladev holding the plow, reciting Krishna's words, transmuted into the form of Shyamasundara, dressed in yellow cloth, holding his bamboo flute. And then again, it shifted, and it was Baladev, in whose mind Krishna was speaking his own words, and then it went back to Baladev narrating the message of love which Krishna entrusted to him. And then Krishna woke up, and he was in his ornate palace room in Dwarka, hearing the crashing waves of the ocean and the reverential hymns of the Dwarkavasi birds. He said, "Was that a dream? I thought I was in a moonlit kunj, hearing the lapping waves of Jamuna and the sweet singing of the Brijavasi birds. Was it a dream? Did I go there? But I feel the presence of the Brijavasis, but I'm in Dwarka. What happened? Who can I ask? Where's Balaram?" "I'll have to wait for him to return." And Baladev stayed there for 2 months, immersing the Brijavasis in topics of Krishna. And then one night, when he was drinking that Varuni with his own gopis, and his eyes began to roll, and he began to sway, and he said, "Jamuna, come here." And she was thinking, "He's drunk." And she didn't come. He drew her to him with his plow, which to this day glorifies the region known as Ramanreti, where Baladev has again appeared with Krishna. But for those who are not attuned to the culture of loving relationships found in the forest, I would like to inform you that with the coming of Baladev, a mood has awakened amongst the local earthlings to return to the ways of the earth. And by the gracious support of our Balavanta Prabhu, the personification of the southern aristocracy, in appreciation of Jatayu's expertise and appreciation of the noble occupation, agriculture, the culture of loving relationships, in which everything interacts as a synergy for those who haven't experienced agriculture in contrast to agribusiness. The plow, which is pulled by the oxen, does not exploit the earth or pollute the environment. The ox eats grass, which you have to cut anyway. But it doesn't take a lawnmower, dependent on plundering the earth of her blood. The ox is very happy to eat that grass, which he makes into power. And he works all day. And I used to have a little bit of a critical attitude towards the cows. You know, the oxen are working all day pulling a plow, and the cows are lying in the shade under the tree chewing their cud. And I was thinking, it's not fair. Until I realized that making milk is actually hard work. It's internal. You know, it may appear sometimes that Mataji's are not doing as much as the men, but they're actually doing a lot more internally. So they both eat the grass, which you have to cut. The cows make milk. The ox makes power. They both make manure. Black gold. And when they're doing their work, they're not polluting, they're not corrupting, they're not contaminating the ecosystem. It's part of a synergy. Everything is encouraging, enhancing, enriching everything else in contrast to technology and industry, in which everything is corrupting, exploiting, contaminating everything else. It's a syndrome. Everything goes down until it's all lost. Do we need tractors? Srila Prabhupada said it's the killer of the bull. It requires plundering the earth of iron ore, smelting factories, railroads, ugra karma, exploitation, pollution, degradation. And the whole media and educational institutions and medical, which support this plundering economy, they're corrupting your noble nature by their propaganda. Promoting as progressive what is actually regressive. So Krishna's design for the world is synergy. So you plunder the iron ore, smelting factories, rubber factories to make this monster tractor. But the thing is, if you're egotistic, or your senses are not in control, you're not in control of your senses, or you're not communicating properly, or you're not honoring a relationship, the oxen will not work for you. They simply will not comply. The tractor will. And it'll raise your false ego and your egotism by how much you can plow in a day. But then overproduction inevitably kills agriculture. And the agribusiness has come in. And the tractors don't make manure. They make pollution. And in the life of oxen don't reproduce unless you're like me and you farm with bulls, but in the life of a cow, I mean, how many times have they reproduced? So when you're farming with oxen, you're thinking, you know, everything is encouraging, enhancing, enriching everything else. And we used to have a standard in the plow department that if you spread manure in the field, you had to plow it in that day. And when you're plowing with a team of oxen, and that manure touches the earth and is instantly turned underneath, he's like, we didn't lose anything into the sun. It's a perfect system. And then by the time it dies, the tractor never reproduced itself. And it's not biodegradable. You got another lump of toxic waste contaminating. Even when it's born, when it lives, when it dies, it's always just contaminating, corrupting, diminishing everything. The syndrome of technological, industrial, plundering economy. What is the alternative? When Lord Nityananda was roaming around Hastinapur, he was calling out, "May the wielder of the plow protect us all," and everybody looked at him like, "What is he talking about?" And what does the agribusiness grower do when a tractor dies? What does the farmer do? Those who have worked according to Krishna's plan, when the oxen have died, their mother has replaced them several times over. When the tractor dies, so the farmer's making headway back to earth and back to Godhead. The agribusiness grower has to go back to the banker and take another loan before he ends up in the pawn shop, in the blood bank. And when you're farming with oxen, you know, you go into a consciousness of bounty. That Krishna's providing everything so naturally, so wonderfully. And then if you get on a tractor, your mind goes into calculating. What's that sound? Is that a bearing going out? It's not going to heal if you just turn it out in pasture. Somebody's got to pay for that. There's going to be downtime, lost production, back to the banker. Farming Krishna's way, you're immersed in this synergy, this consciousness of bounty, this faith that Krishna's providing everything we need. You go to the other way, and you get into this calculating scarcity consciousness. How am I going to make it? But what is the real bounty? You know, when Mahaprabhu came back to Kumarhat, he wanted to take the dust from the earth where Ishwara Puri appeared in this world. And he ate that dust and went into ecstasy, and he kept some in his cloth. Every day he would eat some of that dust, offering that prayer, "This dust is the treasure of my heart, the life of my soul, because it comes from the place where Ishwara Puri was pleased to make his descent into this world." And then he went to Srivas Thakur's house. And Vasudev Dutt and Srivas Thakur, Vasudev Dutt and Shivananda Sen, they all converged at Srivas Thakur's house. And everyone was so elated that because they could not stay in Navadvip Nam after Mahaprabhu left. All those Leelastans which gave their hearts such pleasure when Mahaprabhu was there just gave them pain. And they had to leave Navadvip when Mahaprabhu took sannyas, taking shelter in Kumarhat. And when Mahaprabhu came there, they were so elated. And the festivities went on day and night, on and on, until one day Mahaprabhu took Srivas to a private place and sat him down and said, "Srivas, I'm concerned. I've noticed that every day you don't go anywhere. You don't go out to work and you don't go out to beg. You don't go anywhere. How do you maintain your family?" He said, "Providence maintains my family. Whatever we need just comes." Mahaprabhu said, "You should take sannyas." He said, "No, I have no qualification to take sannyas." He said, "Then you should at least go out and beg. You have a large family. How do you maintain them now? I don't know. How will you maintain them in the future? I don't know. You must get a job or go out begging. Do something for the maintenance of your family. How will you maintain them?" And Srivas goes, 1, 2, 3. And Mahaprabhu said, "What does that mean? I can't understand how that answers my question about how you will maintain your family. Can you please explain what this 1, 2, 3 means?" And he said, "This is my solemn vow that if 3 times the sustenance we need does not come to the door, then I'll drown myself in the Ganges." Hearing that, Mahaprabhu rose up and began to roar as he would when he was in uncontainable ecstasy. He said, Srivas, what did you just say? You have that much faith? Remember what I said in Bhagavad Gita 9:22? That for those who worship me with undivided exclusive attention and devotion, always meditating on my transcendental form, I provide whatever they need and preserve whatever they have. I bring it, I carry it on my head, and deliver it to their door, those who are so surrendered. Not only my devotees, those who even remember my devotees, I take care of all their needs. Then he called from Ramai, Ramai, Ramai Pandit, serve your big brother as if he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The servants of my devotees will never perish under any circumstance. When the whole universe is dissolved at the time of the apocalypse, my devotees are not affected. They just go on with their service in surrender and faith and love. My Sudarshan Chakra protects them in all circumstances. So, we may wonder, how can we make this episodic paradigm shift back to the lifestyle that Krishna promoted and Srila Prabhupada advocated? How will we pay the bills? What Mahaprabhu said about Sri, and he said, Mahaprabhu to Srivas, he repeated the exact same words he said in Navadvipa after that whole, terror of the boatloads of Muslim soldiers coming to capture and torture and kill Srivas's whole family, and they just went out with their kirtan. And what Mahaprabhu said there, he said the same thing in Kumarhat. If the day ever comes that Lakshmi Devi herself has to go out with a begging bowl asking for alms, there will never be any scarcity in the house of Srivas. I will bring him whatever he needs. What were we talking about? Oh, how will we pay the bills? And Mahaprabhu also said, even if Lakshmi has to go out begging, there won't be any scarcity. What kind of bounty will there be in the house of the devotees? Wealth, happiness, health, and bhakti. They will abound by the principle of synergy. There will be no scarcity. Because there's only one scarcity in all the world. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, only one famine, only one poverty, scarcity of Krishna consciousness. If we're rich in consciousness, there will be bounty in our lives. But really, the bounty that we cherish is bhakti. So now that Krishna Balaram have appeared, and simultaneously there is a resurgence of this remembrance of Srila Prabhupada's instruction. It was more than instructions. When Srila Prabhupada was ready to leave this world, at one point he said, I have no regrets. And then he changed it. He said, I have one regret. I failed to establish Varnashram. Not that farm life and Varnashram are synonymous, but they're interdependent. And how can you be happy just working out there in the fields? Because you're part of the synergy, the culture of loving relationships called agriculture, the design Krishna not only practiced, but inspired that others follow, so that we become peaceful, happy in this life, and return back home in the end. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
I tried my best, but it's not possible to establish varnasram. Therefore, we should just make devotees. I wonder why he said that also.
Therefore, we should what?
Make devotees. And preach.
Make devotees?
Yeah. He said, I tried, but the Kali Yuga effect is so heavy, it is not possible to establish varnasram dharma.
During his lifetime.
Yeah, it's in the Veda base.
But he cast the seeds.
Yes.
Mahaprabhu desired that the holy name spread to every town and village. It didn't happen in his lifetime, but he planted the seeds.
Okay.
See, agriculture is a wonderful thing because you gather all your bags of seed in the corner of the field and look, what bounty, what wealth. And then they broadcast the seeds and it's all gone. You don't see anything. But then the rains come and then little sections here and there become green. And soon the whole field is bountiful with consistent vegetation. And the seed that you sowed multiplies many, many, many times. Mahaprabhu, he planted the seeds for an age of prema. Srila Prabhupada planted the seeds. And he instructed us to cultivate them.
Thank you for this Dhenukasara story. Srila, as you have mentioned nicely, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur gave comment on that too, that the fault of Dhenukasura was that he never tasted the tal fruit. At least he should have tried to taste it. Neither he allowed anybody to taste it. So when coward boys came to taste it, he was opposing.
That's right.
So he's in
We have this high lofty fruit, but since I can't taste it, I'll make sure nobody can.
Yeah, that's the honor of the demon.
Yeah.
Yes.
But if he had tasted it, he would have been intoxicated by it and wanted to share it with others. And it also shows you the mentality of Kamsa. Kamsa knew, that this tall forest will be very enchanting to devotees because they're going to want to offer it to Krishna. But he had a strict rule that everything must be offered to Kamsa. So he had the best of his guard donkeys protecting that region.
Now Sanatana Goswami says that he was a sahosik. He was cursed by the sage. He is a great grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, whom Krishna told or promised that I won't kill your descendant.
Right.
That's why Balaram had to kill.
That's right. Terrible. This is a little cynical question. You have to forgive me a little bit, hopefully. But it seems from a historical standpoint, there's been a heck of a lot of agricultural societies that may have had a dearth of Krishna consciousness. It seems the agricultural foundation itself doesn't elicit the Krishna consciousness. In fact, there's a long history of very horrific experiences in the human condition in non-industrial societies as well, in third world countries.
I'll give you a little bit more food for cynicism. In our movement, sometimes devotees who are very attracted to Krishna become more attracted to the land and the cows.
What's so cynical about that? Oh, I see what you're saying.
So I'll tell you a pastime. We were working in the fields one day in New Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada was there at the time. And unscheduled for any morning walk or any such thing, Srila Prabhupada just began walking across the meadow. So the devotees who were working in the fields just trailed in behind him. And Srila Prabhupada was chanting and he was kind of absorbed in something. So he was walking across the meadow and the devotees were following in the trail. And in the middle of the meadow he turned around and looked at the devotees. And the Brijavasis in those days, they all had cow manure stains all over their dhotis and saris, and they wore big boots because of the mud that Radhanath Swami was telling us about yesterday. And Srila Prabhupada looked at these devotees, and we were really criticized a lot by the rest of the world. Srila Prabhupada looked at those and he began beaming in this brilliant smile. He said, these devotees are not opulent, but they are jolly. And when he said jolly, he just smiled with such pleasure. And then he turned around and kept walking a little bit farther, and he was just all blissful. And he turned around again, and the devotees stopped, and they gathered around him, and then he became quite grave. And he said, you don't know how fortunate you are. You have the land, the cows, and Sri Sri Radhavanchaman Tundra. Then he became even more grave, and he repeated, you don't know how fortunate you are. Now that was a very simple, spontaneous, and sweet episode, but considering the context, we were really being criticized heavily. Because anytime any new Vrindavan devotee showed up in any city temple, they would have these cow dung stains over their dhotis and saris, and they would have this fragrance like cows, which to us was nice, but you show up in a city temple and they don't appreciate. And why don't they distribute books? And why aren't they just out there working in the fields? But Srila Prabhupada shows so much pleasure from that. But there is a tendency that you can become very attracted to Krishna and get very enchanted with the land and the cows and forget what Bhakti Raghava Maharaj really emphasizes: land, cows, and Krishna. That's like a triangle that makes your bhakti firm. So there were agrarian based cultures in the past that weren't especially Krishna conscious, although most of them were theistic in their own right. Not all. So there's no merit in that. The merit, the fortune, is in the balance. Because if you have a balance in your understanding of the relationship between land, cows, and Krishna, that will balance your understanding and your relationship with everything. And that balance, that harmony, awards the peace which the soul is ever seeking, and happiness is an outgrowth of peace. And since we're all searching for satisfaction, not that everybody be farmers, but at least they be favorable and appreciative of an agricultural component to Srila Prabhupada's movement, because he was very concerned that that not be lost. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Seeing you, the